From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Each week we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Ira Katznelson speaking on The Europe the New Deal Made, Current Tensions in Historical Perspective.
The line, we all remember, nothing to fear but fear itself, was not an applause line. The crowd was indifferent to that. Where they got really excited was where Franklin Roosevelt said, the emergency is so powerful and dramatic. If Congress does not legislate, I am prepared to rule by executive power. We've forgotten this quasi-dictatorial threat of a great man, a great president.
How the New Deal shaped European liberalism and its effect on U.S.-Europe relations in our own time. Tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Secretary of State Colin Powell insists the United States is in striking distance of getting the votes needed in the UN Security Council for a new resolution setting a March 17th deadline for Iraq to disarm or face military action. Powell and other administration officials are stepping up efforts to win support for the measure. NPR's Janet Babin reports.
Speaking on Fox, Powell said he's hopeful that up to 10 countries will vote in favor of the measure, which would require Saddam Hussein to disarm by March 17th or face military action. In order to be adopted by the 15-member UN Security Council, the resolution needs at least 9 votes. But Powell acknowledged that even with enough votes, France could quash the resolution.
I would expect the French to do everything they can to stop it, to include possible use of veto, although they haven't used the veto word.
In order to pass, the resolution can't be vetoed by any of the 5 permanent Security Council members, the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, and China. Powell said President Bush believes he's authorized to use force in Iraq, even if the U.N. resolution fails. Janet Babin, NPR News, Washington.
Powell says the U.S. will hold talks eventually with North Korea on the communist government's nuclear weapons program, but Powell told CNN, now is not the time. Democratic lawmakers and presidential hopefuls are accusing the Bush administration of neglecting North Korea while focusing solely on Iraq. The leader of Turkey's ruling party is likely to become that country's new prime minister tomorrow. Recep Tayyip Erdogan won a seat in parliament today, clearing the way for his upward move, a move that could set the stage for another vote on allowing the U.S. to deploy troops in Turkey in advance of a possible war with Iraq. NPR's Guy Raz reports from Ankara.
Turkey's current Prime Minister Abdullah Gül has indicated he'll step aside to allow the leader of his ruling Justice and Development Party to take the reins of government. Despite the fact the party swept victory in last autumn's general election here, Erdogan was ineligible to run for a parliamentary seat. In the meantime, his position as the party leader meant he was treated as Turkey's de facto leader. In a twist of political fortune, Tayyip Erdogan won his parliamentary seat in the same city where he originally violated Turkey's strict laws on secularism. In 1998, a court banned Erdogan from politics for 5 years after he read a speech deemed pro-Islamic. This week, Erdogan will begin to form a new cabinet. Soon after, he's expected to call on parliament to reconsider a motion on whether to allow U.S. troops to deploy here. Guy Raz, NPR News, Ankara.
Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat says he will retain control of security forces and peace negotiations after his deputy is appointed prime minister tomorrow. That would not satisfy demands by the U.S. and Israel that Arafat give up power. 2 tour buses collided in California this afternoon, injuring more than 100 people. The crash occurred on a major highway from Las Vegas into California. This is NPR.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. Members of a new, smaller board of directors preparing to take over Ocean Spray say that they are open to all options, including selling the brand. The coalition says the smaller board would be more representative of a small-scale growers and to open to selling the brand name. A battle has been raging within the Lakeville-based cooperative over whether it should stay independent or sell out to a larger company with more marketing power. The new, smaller board was approved yesterday. The Wheaton College president at Norton says that she will step down next June to make way for new leadership. Dale Rogers Marshall, who's 65, has led the liberal arts college for the past 12 years. After starting in 1992, she completed the transition of the former all-women's college to a completely co-ed institution. And fire officials have shut down 2 more Pawtucket businesses for safety problems that they say threaten the public. Makuto's nightclub was closed on Friday, and the City Nights Diner Theater was shut down yesterday. The shutdowns are a part of an ongoing inspection sweep ordered by the governor after the West Warwick nightclub fire that killed 99 people. It's 9:05. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MathLab and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. MathWorks.com. By WOW, a boutique with artistic clothing, jewelry, and art to wear in sizes extra small to 3X in Newton at 32 Needham Street or 617-558-1WOW. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. In the forecast, mostly clear, brisk tonight, lows going down into the mid-teens, mostly sunny to start tomorrow, then clouding up in the afternoon, colder with highs only in the upper 20s, clear and cold tomorrow night with a low around 15. Right now, 28 in Boston.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight, we will hear the fourth in a series of programs on the current state of the relationship between the United States and Europe, presented under the auspices of the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University. Ira Katznelson, a member of the board of directors of the Institute, will speak on The Europe the New Deal Made, Current Tensions in Historical Perspective. Professor Katznelson is the Ruggles Professor of Political Science and History at Columbia University. He was introduced by Professor John Stone, Chairman of the Department of Sociology at Boston University. Professor Stone.
Our speaker today is Professor Ira Katznelson, Ruggles Professor of Political Science and History at Columbia University. Professor Katznelson is the distinguished author of many books, including Black Men, White Cities, City Trenches, Schooling for All, Marxism in the City, Liberalism's Crooked Circle, and his latest volume, which is due to appear in April but really exists, Desolation and Enlightenment. And I've been asked to make sure that you know about this book so that you can get ready to purchase it. With Ira, I share the experience of completing a doctorate at one of Britain's medieval universities, he at the real Cambridge, and me at the other place. While he was comparing race relations between Britain and America, I was completing a comparative study of race relations between Britain and South Africa. We both published our studies with Oxford University Press, and we both went on to become assistant professors at Columbia, although in different departments, he in political science and me in sociology. I can vaguely recall a conversation we had outside Fairweather Hall, complaining about the differential teaching loads of junior and senior faculty. I'm sure you're blocking on this one. It will be interesting to see if 30 years later, and having experienced a certain amount of professional mobility, we still share the same views on hierarchy in the ivory tower. Perhaps we will discover that at the reception following today's lecture, to which you are all invited. I believe it's just outside here. The title of today's lecture is The Europe the New Deal Made, Current Tensions in Historical Perspective. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Ira Katznelson.
John, thank you so very much. It's a particular treat to be here for more than one reason, old colleagues, dear friends. John may or may not remember this. He reminded me of this, and we have a provost with us, so this is a story for provosts and presidents. In 1970, I think it was 1970 or 71, a group of junior faculty at Columbia tried to organize a union. Because our teaching loads were considerably higher than those of our senior and better paid colleagues. And we demanded a meeting with the president of the university, then William McGill. And President McGill, of course, said we could meet with him, some 70 or 80 junior faculty. We arrived in the magisterial rotunda of Low Library expecting a meeting, and instead there were very elegantly dressed waiters in tuxedos serving canapes and drinks. a social occasion it was, and a friend of ours, a young philosophy professor who's now a psychiatrist, Michael Teitelman, stood up on a chair and said, Bill, for Bill McGill, we're here to talk union, not to drink with you. We insist on a meeting. And McGill, without batting an eye or snapped his fingers, and had a custodian come out and said, bring the chairs out. So he was ready for us. And there, of course, was no junior faculty union. This is not my subject, not my subject today. My subject is really a commentary on four texts. So if you'll bear with me, I'm going to read from four texts very briefly. The first is from a paper written appeared in Daedalus in 1994 by Mark Lilla, called The Other Velvet Revolution, Continental Liberalism and Its Discontents. And Mark Lilla's topic was the focus of his article was a commentary on Guido de Ruggiero's 1924 book, The Story of European Liberalism. And the point Lilla wanted to make, too long a quote to read the whole thing, was basically that De Ruggiero wrote his text at a time when European liberalism, of course, was in deep trouble. Mussolini observed in the mid-1920s, and then again when in 1932 in a long book, all the great political movements of our time, he said, are anti-liberal. And by liberal, or anti-liberal, by liberal, De Ruggiero was referring, and Mussolini was referring, of course, to the European Western tradition associated with Locke and Mill and others, whose core concepts are representation, toleration, consent, constitutionalism, and the like. And that body of thought and practice called liberal contrasted with regimes which increasingly proudly called themselves, as did the Italian, a totalitarian, a word which long precedes the Cold War. In fact, a word invented by anti-Mussolini journalists in 1922-23, including Amendola, and Mussolini then proudly said, yes, I am totalitarian, thank you very much, as opposed to effete, weak, impossible liberalism. Lilla's text makes the point that, quote, every single West European nation today is liberal. Every West European nation has limited constitutional government, an independent judiciary, multi-party elections, universal suffrage, civilian control of the military and police, rights to free assembly and worship, a large middle class, and a developed consumer private property economy. I'm going to use, even you can leave aside the economic reference, though that's not irrelevant to what I'm about to say, but I'm simply going to treat and use the word liberal as Lilla does, as a part of our current political environment, which is widely shared across the Atlantic, and indeed, after the fall of communism, is widely shared across virtually all of Europe. And I'm going to argue, as you'll see, that current tensions in American-European relations are less about whether to have liberalism and more about what kind of liberalism we might wish to have. My second text is the text of an advertisement. But an advertisement, if I can find it quickly, put in Foreign Affairs in May, June 1997 by Daimler-Benz. It reads, "We salute a bold investment that paid off handsomely. In 1947, our factories, like many in Europe, were rubble. Today, we are a leading provider of transportation and traffic products, systems and services on both sides of the Atlantic. Thank you, General Marshall. Thank you, Americans, our friends, our partners, our customers, our employees." Third text comes from a very good scholar, now Dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, formerly at the Harvard Law School, Anne Marie Burley. This is from an article called "Regulating the World: Multilateralism, International Law, and the Projection of the New Deal Regulatory State." I just read the first paragraph. The multilateralism that characterizes post-war international regimes is a fundamental characteristic of a liberal world order. In particular, it is characteristic of international institutions designed by the United States, the liberal state most inclined and most able to project its domestic, political, and economic arrangements onto the world. The distinctive features of multilateralism, the emphasis on general organizing principles with the corollary characteristics of indivisibility and diffuse reciprocity, are also the organizing principles of the liberal conception of a polity. The United States sought to project those principles onto the world as a macrocosm of the New Deal regulatory state. And the very last text on which my talk, about which my talk is a commentary, arrived on my desk yesterday, so I can't say it was a long planned for part of this talk. It was written by my colleague in history, Volker Berghahn, a very distinguished historian of Germany and of Europe more generally, who directs the Institute for the Study of Europe at Columbia. And this is the beginning of his newsletter for the spring semester to us, to his colleagues and students. It is a sign of uncertain times in which we live that by the time this newsletter appears, we may well be facing a shooting war in the Middle East. The process of world history that was enormously accelerated by al-Qaeda's attacks on New York and Washington no doubt will see a further acceleration. Even if the Bush administration succeeds in putting together a broad coalition in support of a military intervention against Saddam Hussein, its members, including the British, will be more reluctant partners than they were in the Gulf War and the more recent war against the Taliban. One reason for this reluctance on the European side will be continuing unhappiness over Washington's unilateralism. No other document articulates this unilateralism more clearly than the new U.S. strategic doctrine of September 2002. Europeans are still grappling with the revolutionary implications of this doctrine for the future of international relations and the future of Europe. Now, I think you begin to see an interweaving of themes and puzzles. My subject today concerns the tensions which currently characterize U.S.-European ties. They're manifest. They're on page one of the newspaper almost every day. We can see them in the United Nations. We can see them at press meetings. We can see them in popular mobilizations and the like. None of what I have to say in this only, I promise you, semi-assured talk, I'm talking about matters which are at some distance from my ordinary expertise, none of what I have to say is meant to substitute for, nor is it a competitor for, analyses that stress the doctrine of preemption or the rhetoric of this or that president of the United States, or cultural tensions across the Atlantic in worldviews. What I do want to do is to put current tensions into some kind of particular historical and relational context. I'm not going to present what might be called comparative history, but relational history. That is, I'm particularly interested in the dynamic over a long period of time, the past half century or more, past six decades, of ties between the United States and Europe, and then try to situate current relations in that context. And there essentially are four pieces to this extended colloquy or argument. The first of these pieces concerns the kind of moment we are in, which, not inventing a term at all, I will call a critical juncture, but a critical juncture in the sense of a period of uncommon uncertainty and openness, not with respect to a laundry list of issues, but with respect to the character of the contemporary liberalism we who live in the West, in North America and in Europe, would wish to have. That is to say, putting it differently, I think that the liberal political tradition essentially problematizes, worries about, creates rules for four distinct sets of relationships, and each is open and in question right now. The first set of rules are rules that concern membership. Who gets to be a liberal citizen? Think of issues of immigration, or in the United States, issues of race and ethnicity. First question is a question, set of questions about membership. The liberal tradition, second, consists of rules about international relations, the character of the state system, the nature of trade and geopolitics. Third, the liberal political order, any liberal political order, is an order of rules that govern the relationships between government or state and the economy. How shall private property, markets, be regulated by public authority? And last, liberalism consists of a set of rules concerning interactions between state and citizen. And these rules concern everything from the character of political representation to the nature of permissible behavior, issues of morality, as well as issues of culture. Each of these zones is a zone of ideas and a zone of institutions. Critical junctures for modern liberalism are those junctures when the rules of transaction or exchange between the state and its citizens, the state and the economy, the state and other states, and the state and actual and prospective members, when all those rules are up for question or challenge simultaneously. There is no such thing as capital L liberalism. The liberal tradition is always contested, always up for grabs. But at some moments, some privileged, if you like, historical moments, the layering of these questions comes one on top of the other with a simultaneity that makes such a moment a critical moment. I believe, and I'll end here, that we are at such a critical juncture, and we've twice before been at such a juncture in the past 60 years. The first and by far the most important of such junctures came at the close of the interwar period and the Second World War, i.e. with the reorganization and the recrudescence of Western liberalism after its profound collapse in the interwar period, the recrudescence of political liberalism after the Second World War. The second moment, less, if you like, dramatically as critical, but a moment in which each of these transaction sets was brought into question, came in the by the mid to late 1970s into the 1980s, when many of the formulas that had been institutionalized and many of the ideas that had become hegemonic in the immediate post-war period, such as Keynesian economics, came to be called into question by their manifest problems. And new problem solutions, new institutional sets, sometimes calling themselves conservative, but in my linguistic usage, also liberal, just a different kind of liberalism, came to the fore, represented most dramatically in the United States and in Britain by the administrations of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. They were not illiberal. They represented a different kind of liberalism. So the first part of my piece of my argument is to talk a bit about critical junctures, and I'll especially talk about the post-war period that the world, the New Deal, made, and I'll come back to that. Second, I want to argue that the key actors in the West were made or shaped under the direct, indirect, welcome, and resisted influence of the dominant power throughout this period, namely the United States. European liberalism and its options was not shaped, was not made autonomously. Britain was a junior partner throughout in the Marshall Plan experience, for example, in the Thatcher-Reagan partnership, and perhaps today in the as we're probably about to launch a war in the Middle East with Britain. The United States plus Britain, this Atlantic partnership, but where the big player has been the United States, has overwhelmingly set the ideational and institutional conditions within which the Western world has developed contested forms of political liberalism, often against very powerful adversaries like the Soviet Union. So I'm interested, second, in thinking about the constitution of actors, their ideas, their interests, their sense of self, the repertoire of alternatives they have within a framework largely fashioned by the United States. Third, I want to turn to the United States and to underscore what I believe to be a key but semi-hidden aspect of the way in which America has helped shape Europe and the manner in which current dilemmas are unfolding. And that semi-hidden aspect I believe to be the role of the southern region of the United States in shaping the politics of the United States. Then, in the first of my critical junctures, in the middle during the Reagan years, and now. And let me just flag that. I've even brought along some data, but we'll see if time permits my launching into roll call analysis of the Congress in the 1940s, the 70s, and the recent past. Probably not, but we can do that in question and answer if it interests you. But I will want to show that the southern region of the United States, that is the representatives in Washington of the 17 states, there's a great irony here about not only the revival of Western liberalism, but of the securing of liberalism globally, was, from my perspective, to a very significant degree, the work of the least illiberal, the most illiberal section of the United States, the Jim Crow South of the 1930s and 1940s, which was represented in Washington by members of Congress who were elected by a one-party, low-franchise, exclusionary, quasi-totalitarian state, but they became sanitized representatives once they got to Washington, one person, one vote, and they were by far the most internationalist and multilateralist force in the Congress in the 1940s, which is not perhaps uninteresting. And finally, taking these pieces together of like a putting a cubist painting or a portrait together, the facet of critical junctures, the facet of key Western actors and how they were constituted in Europe under the auspices of the United States, and then the southern dimension of American action, taking those three together, I'll conclude by making a few suggestions about the shape of current tensions within Europe and across the Atlantic between Europe and the United States. So that's what I'd like to do in the next 25 minutes or so. First, critical junctures. A critical juncture is a moment of more than uncommon uncertainty. A rather great economist who worked at a university I once was privileged to work at, the University of Chicago, Frank Knight, wrote in the 1920s about risk and uncertainty and made the argument that moments of especially high uncertainty are not only moments when individuals and groups find it difficult to assess probabilities of outcomes, but when they're not even sure what the game is within which there are probabilities for outcomes. Certainly in the interwar period, this was true for Western democracies, especially the surviving ones, as they watched some 20 constitutional regimes topple one by one across the Western world, including Latin America, including Japan. At that moment, uncertainty was so deep. And that uncertainty, I believe, carried through the Second World War into the occupation of Japan and Germany. The uncertainty was so deep that actors themselves were not sure whether they could and how they could, if they could, reconstitute an arena in which political liberalism could thrive. That is, regimes with all those constitutional and ideational and rights rules that that Mark Lilla citation I read following his article on De Ruggiero commented on. Uncertainty at such moments becomes constitutive of politics. We think we know who and what we are and what our identities are, but suddenly we discover we're really not sure because we don't know enough about the context in which we're located. Now, about what are we uncertain? We're not only uncertain at such moments about political identities, but we're uncertain, as I said a moment ago, I believe, about determinate or limited sets or of rules or sites of transaction between modern states and key others, their citizens, their marketplaces, other states, and the issue of membership and prospective members and actual members. The moments of highest uncertainty are the moments when the deeply uncertain actors must work to recreate, as if sometimes de novo, rules of exchange between all of those or amongst all of those elements. Now, it seems to me not difficult to argue that the period beginning with the collapse of capitalism globally in 1929 and ending, let's say, in the United States with the election of Eisenhower in 1952, that long period was a period of astonishing uncertainty in each of these dimensions. I recently showed a class of mine a film of Franklin Roosevelt's first inaugural. And very interesting, the line, the very famous line we all remember, nothing to fear but fear itself, was not an applause line. The crowd was indifferent to that. Where they got really excited was where Franklin Roosevelt said, the emergency, I'm paraphrasing now, but near the end of the speech, the emergency is so powerful and dramatic that I'm about to send to Congress an agenda of legislation to deal with this emergency. But if Congress does not legislate, I am prepared to rule by executive power. We've forgotten this quasi-dictatorial threat of a great man, a great president. So uncertain were the times that the very basic rules of American constitutionalism were brought into question in the first inaugural of Roosevelt, and that was the great applause line you could see on the film of his speech. A speech given just a day or two after the German elections confirmed the Chancellor Hitler and the Nazi Party in office. That was the environment, and that charged environment governed not only by the collapse of capitalism, of course, but the rise of multiple forms of deep illiberal totalitarianism in Stalinist Russia and in Nazi Germany, and the soft versions of fascism and authoritarianism of the right-wing kind across much of Europe. In that environment, uncertainty had this charged, jagged quality that lasted well through the post-war years into the cold, well into the Cold War. And actually, I believe our historians or our historiography has forgotten the depth of that uncertainty. We read this backwards as the origins of a moment of great success. The New Deal created all the things, some of the things we like, whether we're Republicans or Democrats. We like Social Security in one form or another, and so on and so forth. And we like NATO. We like. Well, all these institutions and developments were created in a period which historians at earlier writing almost always underscored as the result of uncommon uncertainty and experimentation without knowledge of probabilities and even of who the actors were as they were behaving. Now, it was in that context that the modern U.S.-Europe set of relations was fashioned. But it was not only that the The constitution of Europe was shaped in this manner. It's that Europe, and this is too boldly put, became, as it were, an extension of the left center of the American New Deal. That is to say, whether you read Erwin Wall writing about France in 1948 or you go through a whole history list of first-rate histories of the post-war period, what to me, as a, primarily as an Americanist, is so astonishing is the way in which the terms of reference offered within by the New Deal, within American politics, the set of choices offered, and the set of choices rejected within American political life then were mapped almost perfectly onto much of European politics. For example, there is much more that post-war European social democrats in Germany, among other places, in Austria, had in common with the left wing of the New Deal than with pre-war more capital M Marxist social democracy in Germany or in Austria. Post-war Europe excluded Western Europe. Eastern Europe was under Soviet domination. Western Europe excluded both the fascist right-wing options, which had been so present, even hegemonic in Europe in the 1930s, and excluded the Bolshevik options and anything too close to the Bolshevik options, even when there were vigorous communist parties at work, as there were in France and in Italy. The range of options was New Deal. And this is not entirely by accident. First, there had been a widespread delegitimation of the non-New Deal, if you like, choices open to Europe. But second, there was a powerful institutional presence of the United States in Europe through a host and a range of institutions created during and after the Second World War, whether the economic institutions of Bretton Woods, whether or not the United Nations, which the United States was not just European, but which the United States surely dominated with European partners, whether the Marshall Plan, which was almost exclusively staffed, as Michael Hogan has shown, by New Dealers and left-wing New Dealers at that, whether it was NATO, and a host of other institutions, small and large. Modern Europe was created in the image of the New Deal. Interestingly, Karl Polanyi, in his great book, The Great Transformation, understood that only the New Deal was the option to Bolshevism and fascism. He wrote, Europe faces in 1944, there are only three options in the West, he wrote. The New Deal, fascism, socialism, and by socialism he meant Bolshevism, and the New Deal. That was it. And indeed, it was the New Deal and its version of liberalism that became hegemonic in Europe. Of course, not without opposition, not without conflict about what the New Deal meant, but that was as much true within America as outside. So there was, not to coin a term, if you know Dan Rogers' book on the progressive era, there was a new Atlantic crossing. But this crossing was ideas, institutions, and power from here to there. Now, there further was a crossing, but a much more minor one in a more minor uncertain moment in the 70s when Reaganite conservatism, call it Reagan-Thatcher conservatism, crossed the Atlantic, but crossed the Atlantic in two distinct ways. First, crossed the Atlantic just as European social democracy was losing a degree of confidence in the New Deal-type formulas, too rigid. The corporatist versions were overly structured. The healthcare versions weren't delivering any healthcare without high costs or, in some cases, as in Britain, with waiting lists, and so on. And the more market-oriented version of conservatism, if you like, to the right of the New Deal or on the right of the New Deal options that was now hegemonic in the United States, came to inform less Europe, much of the older, what our friend Rumsfeld calls the old Europe directly, which still resisted this incursion to some extent, Britain aside, but deeply influenced the imaginary of possibilities in poorer sections of Europe and especially in Eastern Europe still under Soviet domination. It was that vision of Western liberalism that was at the plate, as it were, when communism collapsed. Today, Europe itself is multi-layered in its predilections, in its institutions, in its ideas, in its formulations of liberalism. Europe is uniformly, as Lilla says, liberal, but it's liberal with a spectrum of possibilities. And each of the major options on offer, an option I mean a constellation, a formula of configuration for those rules of exchange between state and market, state and citizen, state and state, and questions of membership. There are today layers, small number of clusters of options about what kind of liberalism Europe and we should want, in the United States as well, should want to have. And the clusters in Europe tend to be configurations that map onto the layers that were fashioned at each of the critical junctures I've referred to. That is, the dominant layering in Europe still is the one the New Deal made. A second layer is a layer that was fashioned deeply under the influence of the Reagan-Thatcher quasi-revolution. And a third layer was fashioned largely in the as a product of American influence in the period after the fall of communism as East Europe joined West Europe. So we have a layering of liberalisms contesting with each other inside Europe today and across the Atlantic. And as each of these Europes, call it liberalism 1, liberalism 2, liberalism 3, look back across the Atlantic at America, they see either friend or foe. That is, the United States, in any particular configuration of administration, seems to have, in fact does have, an elective affinity with one or another of those layers or formulas for liberalism existent in Europe simultaneously today. So it's not, I'm jumping considerably ahead to my end, but it's not entirely surprising, at least not from this formulation, that as Europe looks to America when America again makes demands on it, in this case for allegiance in an international crisis, different Europes who see different positions for the United States and themselves vis-a-vis the liberal tradition respond distinctively. There is not a single European response to America. There is a response to the Europes, from the Europes, to the America that the United States helped make. And that's my second point about the character of the actors at work in the domestic and international systems today. Which brings me to my third perspective. This is actually where I feel the most comfortable and where I actually possess some information. You can say the first 25 minutes of this talk were, I hope not entirely unintelligent, but a kind of speculative positioning as a way of trying to make sense of really complicated and puzzling features of current reality in global relations. This third point about the American South, I hold near and dear to myself. I've been working on a book for too long, which I think will be finished next year, which I call In the Southern Cage, the New Deal Experiment and the Origins of Our Time. I like pretentious titles, right? And obviously there's a play on Weber's Iron Cage and the Southern Cage, because it's my argument, at least for the New Deal period, that given the character of the Democratic Party as a strange bedfellows coalition of a northern social democratic wing and a southern Jim Crow wing in the 1930s and 1940s, given the numbers of southern representatives who numbered about, by my count, 17 southern states, and the way I count them is those were the 17 states that mandated by law racial segregation in the schools. There were, as a footnote, 15 states in the United States that mandated slavery on the eve of the legalized slavery on the eve of the Civil War, and those 15 states plus West Virginia and Oklahoma composed the 17 states that mandated racial segregation. Not, another footnote, the state of Kansas, which was Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, which was one of three states, Arizona, New Mexico, and Kansas, that had what might be called permissive segregation, state law that allowed school districts to racially segregate, and all the other states in the unions, the union forbade racial segregation by law in the schools. Now, that southern system had a supermajority in the United States Senate. That is, they had more than the number of votes needed to filibuster and block a vote. They also controlled committee chairmanships. They had about 40% of the seats in the House, in part because of rural districting and the like. And I think it's fair to say that not one piece of New Deal legislation, not one, whether the Fair Labor Standards Act or earlier the Wagner Act or the Social Security Act or the, going back to the beginning, the NIRA, National Industrial Recovery Act, not one could have been passed into law without Southern votes or against Southern opposition. So that the New Deal had to be shaped and tailored to Southern preferences. What were Southern preferences with regard to the international environment and with regard then also to post-war Europe? And here, in a period where some historians already are writing about so-called conservative coalition of Southern Democrats and Republicans, there is not only zero evidence of a, quote, conservative coalition, there's overwhelming evidence, I hold in my hand a list, as someone might have said, of something like 800 roll calls conducted in the 30s and 40s on international global topics, that is to say on defense matters, on international political economy, questions of trade, essentially, and on geopolitics, votes on whether or not to have NATO votes, etc., foreign aid, and the like. And if you study closely or even not so closely the roll call data and imagine that Congress was divided into three groups, Southern Democrats elected from their very peculiar electoral system, non-Southern Democrats and Republicans, and just see how they coalesce together, what one finds is that overwhelmingly the Southerners are voting 100% for the most internationalist of policies. They are the most geared to open trade. They have raw materials they want to sell in the world, cotton, tobacco, and the like. They are not an industrial region in much of this period. They don't have industries to protect very much. Second, they are keenly in favor of building a strong military and a national security state, both before, during, and all Americans during, but after the Second World War. And they are keenly in favor of fashioning multilateral, especially cross-Atlantic, liberal organizations, including NATO, Marshall Plan, and the like. And if you look at these votes, you discover that the likeness, the similarity of the way in which Southerners vote with Northern Democrats or non-Southern Democrats is much higher than the likeness as it were, of Southern Democratic voting with Republicans or Southern Democratic or Republican voting with non-Southern Democrats. That's, if you look at those three pairs, it's the Southern Democrat, non-Southern Democrat option that provides the coalition. In short, it's the New Deal coalition that shapes the multilateral world that the United States builds. At the second moment, by the time of the second moment of the reconstruction of post-war liberalism, the moment of Thatcher and Reagan, the southern wing of the American Democratic Party had begun a rather robust departure from the ranks of the Democratic Party. Increasingly, the likeness in voting was not between Southern Democrats and Republicans now, and by the time Reagan was elected, roughly 50-50, still more Democrats, though, from the South in the House and the Senate than there were Republicans. Not till the 90s do the numbers tilt with a large majority of Republicans from the South. Even as the two parties were more finely balanced, the Southerners had moved their likeness into what in the United States we call the conservative camp. That is to say, they were voting as a product of our democratic civil rights revolution. The white South moved into the Republican Party as the Republican Party also pursued a Southern strategy. And that reshaping was far less radical than the New Deal, post-New Deal reshaping of liberalism, but it was a reshaping at least in nuance and emphasis nonetheless. And today, the United States is governed by a unified government where, despite the fall of Trent Lott, the role of the southern wing of the Republican Party, a president, leadership in both houses, and indeed a particular form of conservatism, also liberal by my definition, extended definition of liberalism, so I'm not using the word liberal in the ordinary speech of American politics. This conservatism, which I believe not to be identical to the early Reagan and Thatcher years, but something more distinctive on the spectrum, we can talk about that, which is also more southern in its political base, is the liberal version, which actually has had quite a robust affinity, especially with the eastern part of Europe, the post-communist part of Europe, and which today constitutes the heart of the worldview and the alliance, not the only part, that wishes to move, say, from containment to preemption as a hallmark of foreign policy, and that wishes to move to an even more aggressive market orientation in domestic politics, and wishes to move towards a more, in some sense, authoritarian version of state-centered morality in other matters, including matters of sexuality. But that's a distinct constellation of rules for liberalism. And what we have, as I want to draw to a close then, a product, a current situation in which the United States that faces Europe, the face of the United States to Europe, remains a face of liberalism. That is, the United States is a liberal regime in the sense that I've been using the term. The Bush administration is a liberal, in that sense, administration. But it is a highly distinctive kind of liberalism, one whose rhetoric, whose policy orientations, whose preferences, whose choices, and whose configuration of rules at each of those dimensions is highly distinctive and very assertive. And it's that America which faces toward Europe and that Europe is reacting to. And the reaction of Europe, I believe, has come in three layers. One layer, where we see the most resistance, comes from that Europe that was made by, in the case of Germany, made via occupation by, the New Deal moment of constituting and reconstituting liberalism. The second, the more ambivalent, the most ambivalent part of Europe not that there isn't ambivalence everywhere, including in my own psyche and soul, but where you see more ambivalence tends to be in countries that threw off the yoke of authoritarianism of one kind or another, but not to use, if you'll allow me the language of contrasting authoritarianism and totalitarianism, threw off the yoke of authoritarianism of one kind or another, especially in southern Europe, say Spain and Portugal, which has an affinity to the moment of the Reagan-Thatcher assertion of liberalism. And we could talk about Italy, a much more complicated and interesting case, which itself had, in effect, a rebellion of a kind of Reagan-Thatcher sort against the Christian Democratic version of the New Deal. But that's I'm no Italy specialist, as you've already heard by that one sentence. And finally, the Eastern Bloc, the post-totalitarian former Soviet bloc, has by far the most enthusiastic affinity with the world of the kind of liberalism that wasn't made by the New Deal and wasn't made by Reagan-Thatcher, but the kind of liberalism made by current President Bush. So this, in short, is an attempt to place these conundrums of the present in too simplified to be sure, but perhaps somewhat persuasive analytical and schematic history. Footnote, the last footnote. I wrote a piece in Daedalus about a year ago called Evil in Politics. It was in the aftermath of September 11. And what I said then at a slightly abstract level, mostly I wrote it because I was keenly upset, obviously, both with the might be called direct physical assault on values I and we hold most dear, but also on the reaction by I'm broadly positioned myself on the left, by many of my colleagues on the left who responded in what to my taste was too cool a register to September 11th. And I wanted to make the point that what most to me came to the fore post September 11 was the challenge of defining, and here I'm repeating myself from the very beginning of the talk, and I know that, of defining not whether we should wish to have liberalism, but we were now challenged again to think through the kind of liberalism we wish to have. And I think that question of what kind of liberalism we wish to have is precisely the kind of question again put on the agenda by both global and domestic matters at the beginning of this new century. So thank you very much.
Professor Ira Katznelson of the Board of Directors of the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University, speaking on The Europe the New Deal Made, Current Tensions in Historical Perspective. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Andy Farnsworth with help from John Hoder. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is Bob Oakes. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, the latest on Iraq and the buildup to the possible war. Also, a report on retirees as Florida competes with Alabama and Mississippi to attract older, wealthy residents. Those stories and all the news tomorrow on Morning Edition, starting at 5, here on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
This is WBUR. Coming up just ahead at 10 o'clock after the news, it's BBC Assignment. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Barrett Communications, building collaborative client relationships with the mission to deliver informed web, UI, collateral and logo design solutions in Kendall Square, Cambridge, and on the web at barrett.com, RRTT. By Nantucket Nectars, introduced